It's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, May 14. Hi, I'm Phil Picardi. A lot of big news in the podcast today, from same-sex marriage in the Senate to how it played out in the halls of the state capitol to how it's expected to play out in local communities. Also, two Twin Cities men are sentenced for terrorism-related charges. Stadium designers unveil their plans for a new Vikings venue. Small businesses prepare for Minsure. And there's cocaine in them thar lakes. Governor Mark Dayton signs a bill that legalizes same-sex marriage tonight. But as Tom Scheck reports, opponents say the issue is far from settled.
Governor Dayton's signing ceremony will be a big party for supporters of a bill to legalize same-sex marriage. Over the past 2 years, they whipsawed from focusing on defeating a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage to passing a bill that legalizes it.
Guess what? I'm going to be a married man in Minnesota.
That's DFL Senator Scott Dibble of Minneapolis speaking at a rally after the Senate vote. Dibble is the chief author of the same-sex marriage bill. He married his partner, Richard, a few years ago in California. On August 1st, same-sex couples will be able to get married in Minnesota. The state will also recognize same-sex marriages from other states.
This conversation does not stop today. We continue this conversation. We continue to build this movement. I invite people who are not necessarily happy today to open up your hearts. Look at the beauty in this rotunda. How can this be anything but good?
The Senate voted 37-30 to pass the bill. One Republican voted for it. Three Democrats voted against it. The debate was mostly civil, with both sides discussing how their vote will be viewed in the future. DFL Senator Jeff Hayden of Minneapolis said he expects life to get back to normal soon after August 1st.
I think that hopefully when we pass this bill in a few minutes, in a few hours, that you will find that next year when we come back here, that everything is going to be okay in Minnesota, and that people are going to be fine, and that we'll find something else to disagree about, but this won't be one of them.
But as Hayden is predicting few problems as a result of the bill, there is still trepidation about the issue in Minnesota. Two of the Democrats who voted against the measure said their districts overwhelmingly voted to ban same-sex marriage last November. Here's DFL Senator Dan Sparks of Austin after the vote.
I think at the end of the day, though, it really was not a personal vote for me. It was more about representing the district and their wishes. Last November, over 60% of the voters turned out in support of traditional marriage, and so I think it was important for me to reflect their views as we voted today.
Opponents of the bill say they're worried about the impact it could have on religious groups and business owners who object to same-sex marriage. Republican Senator Paul Gazelka of Nisswa was unsuccessful in pushing an amendment that would give greater protections to those groups. He later warned that the debate is not over.
But no matter what the vote is today, it's not going away. You know, they talked about we might be the 12th state that passes this. Well, 32 went the other way. And so how we get through this after this is what I'm concerned about.
Another senator, Republican Warren Limmer of Maple Grove, suggested the law could be challenged in court. And even though four Republicans in the House voted for the bill last week, only one Republican in the Senate, Brandon Peterson, voted for it. Peterson of Andover said he's disappointed no other Republicans joined him. He said it's possible he'll lose his seat because of his vote, but he believed it was the right thing to do. Peterson also said he thinks it would be a mistake for Republicans to whipsaw Minnesota yet again by trying to repeal the law.
But not a single Republican has publicly spoken on repeal of the law if it were to become law, and I hope that they don't. I think that Minnesotans are going to overwhelmingly reject that idea.
Peterson said he thinks younger voters support the bill in large numbers, a key group he says Republicans will need if they want to remain viable in future election cycles.
Tom Scheck at the state capitol. Thousands of non-legislators flooded the capitol yesterday. Some celebrated, others protested. Curtis Gilbert talked to Minnesotans on both sides.
A thunderous cheer rises up from the Capitol Rotunda just moments after the senators cast their votes. Natara Frost wipes tears from her eyes.
It's amazing. The thought that my wife and I have been together for 8 years and we have five beautiful kids and now we can get married.
She holds up a makeshift sign. It's a photo of her family.
My oldest is 8, and then we have a 6-year-old son, a 5-year-old son, a 4-year-old son, and a almost 3-year-old son, and they're all adopted from Minnesota, and so now we can go home and tell the kids, and I'm very excited.
For hours leading up to the vote, supporters of same-sex marriage chanted and cheered and sang until their voices were hoarse. The rotunda was a sea of orange shirts, many left over from last year's campaign against the constitutional amendment that would have banned gay marriage. The shirts still said vote no, but everyone knew this time they meant yes. Tina Fahnestock was one of many who noted the irony.
I'm really happy that the Republican Party put this amendment on the ballot in November because it rallied all of us to push for equality marriage for all people in the state of Minnesota.
Do you think we would be here if they hadn't?
I don't think it would have come this quickly and this sweetly.
The day was not so sweet for opponents of same-sex marriage. They were outnumbered. Their signs urged lawmakers not to erase moms and dads. Some played drums, many prayed.
God, let man's voice not be heard, but let the voice of God be heard. Let your voice ring out high in this place today, God. We need you, Jesus. We need you, Jesus.
Anne Colopy stood not far from the group drumming and praying. She called the day cataclysmic.
You start overturning societal institutions like this, that's big. It's big. And I'm glad I'm older, and I'm glad that I do not have a family. I never married, I don't have children, and I'm glad. I wouldn't wish what's coming on the next generation.
But in spite of Colopy's pessimism, she says opponents of same-sex marriage in Minnesota will still keep fighting.
This isn't going to settle the issue anymore. You know, when Roe v. Wade was handed down, they said, oh, thank God, now this is settled. Well, look, at it's not. I mean, people are having fits about it 50 years later.
Roe v. Wade was actually 40 years ago. A number of same-sex marriage opponents brought it up as a symbol of perseverance. One of them was Father Thomas McCabe, a Catholic priest from Lonsdale. Even though McCabe's side lost this round, he still has a smile on his face.
I'm going to persevere in praying for people. I'm going to persevere in caring for people, whether they're homosexual or straight or just confused. I'm there to call them to get to know the Lord Jesus and to follow reason and God's supernatural laws of salvation.
Opponents of same-sex marriage also vow to campaign against legislators who voted for the bill. Supporters say they'll protect those incumbents and led cheers of "We have your back." But for today, they're just planning to celebrate as Governor Dayton makes Minnesota the 12th state to legalize same-sex marriage.
Curtis Gilbert at the Capitol. The same-sex marriage debate has divided the state. Last November, voters in Olmsted County in southeastern Minnesota were evenly split on an amendment that would have defined marriage as being between one man and one woman. Reporter Elizabeth Baer says the county may not have been so evenly split had it not been for Rochester and the Mayo Clinic.
Nora Dooley, chair of the Olmsted County Human Rights Commission, says last year's vote on the marriage amendment was a watershed that helped her understand Rochester's changing social and political views.
Before, I would have thought we would have had a 75-25. So the mere fact that we had it such a close tells me that things are changing from what used to be, in my opinion, an ultra-conservative part of the state. I think we're kind of becoming more urbanized.
Dooley sits outside the Mayo Clinic's towering Gonda building on a recent afternoon. Doctors in lab coats crisscross the plaza. Bells ring from the nearby Carillon Tower. While Mayo doesn't take official positions on political issues, Dooley attributes some of the clinic's policies to the city's changing landscape. For instance, she says Mayo employees appear more willing to make their personal political views public, including support for same-sex marriage. Last year, a handful of doctors publicly opposed the marriage amendment. In 2000, Mayo started offering domestic partner benefits to same-sex couples. And a decade later, in 2010, Rochester joined a handful of other Minnesota cities that allowed same-sex couples to register as domestic partners.
In some ways, the transformation might have been slow in coming, but maybe the amendment coming forward was actually maybe a good thing in a way, because it got what I think is a silent majority here to finally stand up and say, no, we really want to have equality for everyone.
A transformation has happened in Rochester, but parts of rural Olmsted County are still very conservative. Carleton College political science professor Stephen Shear says the urban-rural divide is much more pronounced in a place like Olmsted County because of Mayo's influence in Rochester. The clinic attracts a large population of high-income professionals who are also highly educated.
And that demographic group tends to be much more sympathetic to gay marriage than, say, rural citizens in the areas surrounding Rochester. And so there's a bigger contrast between Rochester City and the rural areas in southeastern Minnesota than you would perhaps find in other smaller cities.
Cities like Eota, just 10 miles east of Rochester. The ladies of the American Legion collect cash and pack goods at the town's annual garage sale this past weekend. Eota Township residents like 73-year-old Bonnie Albers overwhelmingly voted for the marriage amendment in November. Albers says she opposes gay marriage because of her religious views.
I think it needed to be looked into a lot longer than it has been, and there has to be a better solution. We're going against everything that we've been taught for years, and I don't care what they say, it's not in the Bible.
Her friend, 81-year-old Don Anderson, supports same-sex marriage, but knows expressing political views in small towns is not easy.
I belong to several auxiliary groups, hospital auxiliary, a legion auxiliary, and then, of course, my church groups. And actually, we don't do a lot of chit-chatting. I can't remember in the last month anybody bringing it up.
Anderson says the marriage amendment was the first real measure that helped people here understand how political views were shifting in this part of the state. And as Rochester continues to grow, she expects that rural-urban distinction to become even more pronounced for Olmsted County.
Elizabeth Baer there in Rochester. Two Twin Cities men convicted of terrorism-related charges were sentenced yesterday. Kamal Saeed Hassan and Mahmoud Saeed Omar both played unique roles in the disappearance of nearly two dozen Somali men from the Twin Cities who traveled to Somalia to fight for the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Here's our Brant Williams.
Kamal Hassan and Mahmoud Omar both made one last plea for leniency from Judge Michael Davis before he issued sentences to each man in separate hearings. Hassan choked back tears as he apologized to his family, his community, and his country for leaving the U.S. in 2007 and traveling to Somalia to train with terrorist group Al-Shabaab. In 2009, Hassan pleaded guilty to two charges of providing material support to a terrorist group and later pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. Hassan faced a possible sentence of 38 years in prison. However, Davis reduced his sentence to 10 years because Hassan cooperated with prosecutors and even testified for the government in other terror cases. Court officials say Hassan will also get credit for time served in federal custody, which means he may get 4.5 years taken off his sentence. The second man, Omar, was convicted of 5 terror counts last year and faced a life sentence for conspiracy to kill, kidnap, maim, and injure. Through his interpreter, he gave a rambling screed in the courtroom in which he accused his lawyers of disrespecting him and again denied that he had helped terrorists. Government prosecutors wanted to send Omar to prison for 50 years. Assistant U.S. Attorney John Dougherty told Davis that Omar was a danger to the community. Dougherty also says Omar, a janitor at a local mosque, was an integral part of the conspiracy to funnel money and fighters to Al-Shabaab. Davis gave Omar a 20-year sentence in prison and a lifetime of probation following his release. Omar's attorneys say with credit for time served, Omar will likely be out of prison in 13 years. Attorney John Hopeman says Omar was no criminal mastermind.
We've long thought he was of limited mental capacity and of limited ability to communicate, none in English, and of limited ability to communicate in Somali from what we can tell.
Members of both Hassan and Omar's family sat in the courtroom to observe the proceedings. Many wiped away tears as the sentences were handed down. Also in the courtroom was Hassan Mahmoud, a St. Paul imam who came to observe the proceedings and serve as a spokesman for the families and the Somali community. He says Somalis are concerned about how the sentences look to members of the broader community.
Whatever outcome these cases, starting from today and next couple days, whatever outcome they see, that does not reflect, number one, to the faith of the Muslim community or to the faith of the Somali community.
Seven more people will be sentenced in U.S. District Court this week, including two Rochester women who were convicted of funneling money to al-Shabaab. The convictions are part of what federal officials call Operation Rhino, a sweeping investigation of al-Shabaab recruitment in the United States. Since 2007, about two dozen young Twin Cities men are believed to have left for Somalia to join the group as fighters. Federal prosecutors say they found no evidence that the al-Shabaab recruits were planning any attacks in the U.S.
Brant Williams in Minneapolis. Builders of the new NFL stadium in that city have unveiled their design plans for the new Vikings home. The 1.6 million square foot building will be clad in metal and have lots of glass, but it won't have a retractable roof. Tim Nelson's all over the stadium news.
It's hard to describe the design for a stadium plan to replace the Metrodome. It's angular, it's part fluoroplastic, part ancient Viking sailing ship, and an angular nod to other Minneapolis landmarks like the Walker Art Center and the Guthrie Theater. And the roof won't be opening. Instead, the south slope of the roof will be sheathed in ETFE, a transparent polymer made famous by the glowing exterior of the Beijing National Aquatic Center from the 2008 Olympics. The north half of the new stadium roof will be conventional hard deck roofing, but fans in the stands will be able to see the sky year-round.
We think clear is the new retractable.
That's architect Brian Truby with HKS, the Dallas-based architectural firm picked to design the stadium in September. The company designed Dallas Cowboys Stadium and Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. He says the Vikings' new home, with the transparent roof, will be unlike anything else in the U.S.
The sunshine coming through the ETFE, which looks and behaves like glass, allows the sunlight to pass through to the stands, creating the look and feel of being outdoor with all the temperature and comfort advantages of being indoor.
The stadium will have what planners have been touting as an operable feature. They're planning massive 95-foot doors on the downtown side of the stadium that will pivot open and allow fans to walk through a 350-foot opening in the side of the building. The overall design won praise from Tom Fisher, the dean of the architecture school at the University of Minnesota. He consulted on some of the features of the new stadium, like handling cold weather and snow, but he said some of the other innovations really stood out.
This is going to be an internationally well-known, famous building. It's going to be the most sustainable stadium in the world. It has some features, the largest glazed roof in the world, the largest glass doors in the world, so it's going to be quite spectacular. It's asymmetrical, so it sort of captures the dynamism of the activity inside.
The building will also be high-tech from the outside in. Two massive video boards are planned for either end of the stadium, more than five stories high and 120 feet wide. There will be 1,200 HD TVs mounted through the stadium and a giant 50-foot electronic display outside on a towering peak at one end of the stadium, reminiscent of a ship's prow. Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority Chairwoman Michelle Kelm-Helgen told hundreds of people on hand for the unveiling that the most important feature may be the simplest, a large open field that can accommodate a wide variety of events, from monster trucks to college baseball games.
It will be possible for us to now host events such as Big Ten Championships, the Super Bowl, the Final Four, College Bowl Games, Major League Soccer, we hope, national conventions, music concerts, and perhaps even World Cup matches.
Fans were thrilled with the first look they got at the team's new home.
I think the new design is awesome.
So-called superfan Larry Spooner of Excelsior was tailgating outside the Guthrie after the unveiling, which he admits is the first time he's set foot in the theater.
I tell you, 16 years of my life has been committed to lobbying for this night. What a night. The Super Bowl, we never won. We finally won.
Groundbreaking is expected to be in October. The stadium is supposed to be finished in July 2016.
Tim Nelson in Minneapolis. The city's school district wants to allow individual schools to make their own decisions on curriculum, scheduling, and hiring teachers. Here's Tim Post.
Leaders in the Minneapolis district say they're ready to let some schools decide how to educate students, which teachers to hire and how much to pay them, and how much time students should spend in class. They hope the effort will help close the achievement gap between white students and students of color. The district is proposing to try out the system in the 2015-2016 school year on a handful of struggling schools. In exchange, schools would have to promise students will meet certain goals on academic performance. The proposal would also require changes to teacher contracts. A teachers' union official says she's in favor of giving schools more freedom, but says further discussion needs to take place on the details. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Organizations representing small business have been among the sharpest critics of the new federal health care overhaul. But some small business owners here in Minnesota hope to find new health insurance options thanks to the law and one of its creations, MinSure, the state's new online insurance marketplace. Here's Elizabeth Stawicki.
Businesses with fewer than 50 employees don't have to provide insurance to their workers under the federal health care law, but some business owners like Melissa Martinson want to anyway. Martinson heads Technomics Research, a small health care consulting business in Medina. About 10 years ago, she started shopping for a company health plan for the firm's 5 employees.
Every year I'd go to a number of insurance brokers and say, what can you do for the company? And they would do some analysis and come back and say, well, I'm sorry, but because of, you know, my age, they were unable to do anything better than we could get as individuals.
Martinson is 56, a decade or two older than her youngest workers. She says she's healthy and has no pre-existing conditions. But even so, her age alone jacked up the premium rates for a group plan. So it made more sense for the employees to buy individual plans because they were less expensive. The business helped them shoulder the costs with profit sharing. Martinson is hoping the new online insurance marketplace, MinSure, will offer a small business health insurance plan that's more affordable than the current arrangement. Her hope is based on the federal health care law's insurance reforms. They're designed so small businesses are charged the same baseline rate for each employee's insurance.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed that that means that I will be able to purchase health insurance for everyone in my company.
MinSure's executive director, April Todd Momlove, says the law is designed to alleviate a problem that's kept small businesses, even those with healthy workforces, from getting affordable insurance. Premiums have been based on the health of the individuals in the group being insured. Todd Momlove says small group plans will no longer be able to base premium rates on workers' health conditions.
So today, if you have 6 people, your rates are going to be higher based on the risk. In the future, they can't rate based on your health status, so everybody's in the same pool, and so the rates can average out.
But there are a few big exceptions. Insurers will still be allowed to raise prices based on tobacco use, location, and age of the people in the group, which means Melissa Martinson may be disappointed. But right now, it's too soon to tell. Whether small employers will buy insurance through MinSure or other so-called online health insurance exchanges in the U.S. is a big question mark for the Affordable Care Act and could be for a while. Paul Fronston is a researcher with the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit, nonpartisan Employee Benefit Research Institute. He says there are just too many variables in play to predict prices for health plans and how businesses respond to them.
We don't know what the market's going to look like. And to even look at what happens in 2014 and say that that's it, things change. And businesses change and economics changes and the exchanges will change.
Melissa Martinson is taking a wait-and-see approach. When the health plan rates are available, she'll look to see what rate her business could get as a group while asking each of the people in the company to see what they can get as individuals. Then, she says, as a group, they'll decide which path to take.
Elizabeth Stawicki on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Now some environmental news to close out the podcast. A controversial proposed copper-nickel mine in northeastern Minnesota has reached a major milestone. Here's our Dan Crocker.
The long-awaited revised environmental impact study for Polymet Mining in Hoyt Lakes has been released to several government agencies and Ojibwe bands. The public may review it later this summer. The initial environmental impact statement for the proposed mine was released in 2009, but the EPA called it inadequate. As a result, Polymet has made several changes to the proposed mine. Catherine Hoffman is an attorney with the Minnesota Environmental Advocacy Center.
This is the
moment when the agencies look at the environmental impacts of a project, and if they don't do a good job, then it becomes very difficult to adequately regulate the facility and ensure that environmental impacts are mitigated or minimized later on.
Hoffman says her group will closely scrutinize the study, including water quality modeling, effects on wetlands, and a proposed land exchange.
Dan Crocker there in Duluth. A new study of Minnesota lakes finds more evidence water across the state contains a wide range of chemicals. It turns out chemicals from household products, prescription drugs, and even illegal drugs are common in the water. And as Dan Gunderson reports, scientists are just starting to understand the problem.
Minnesota Pollution Control Agency scientists sampled 50 randomly chosen lakes across Minnesota last year. They tested the water for 125 chemicals. At least one chemical was found in 47 of the 50 lakes. One lake contained 13 different chemicals. The common insect repellent DEET was found in 76% of lakes. Bisphenol A, that's a chemical used in plastics, showed up in more than 40% of the lakes sampled. MPCA researcher Mark Ferre says some of the results are similar to what was found in earlier small studies.
It's confirming what we found in our other studies. But it also showed us some new things that we didn't see before and that are new to us.
The new findings include one of the most commonly prescribed antidepressants, amitriptyline, in nearly 30% of lakes. The veterinary antibiotic Carbadox was found in about 30% of lakes. Carbadox can only be used in hog production in the U.S. It's been banned in Canada and Europe because it can cause cancer. And the illegal drug cocaine showed up in about one-third of the lakes sampled. The MPCA didn't plan to test for cocaine, but it was included in a test that looked at a variety of chemicals. It's not unusual to find cocaine in water leaving sewage treatment plants, and European scientists found cocaine in air samples. Mark Ferre says government estimates put U.S. cocaine consumption at 156 tons a year. He says that's about the same volume as all commonly used pharmaceuticals combined.
So maybe we shouldn't be too surprised that we're also seeing cocaine in our environment like we see some of the other pharmaceuticals as well.
This is the largest in a series of lake studies done in Minnesota. Mark Ferre says the test of 50 lakes is large enough to reflect the condition of all Minnesota lakes.
These studies, probably for the first time, are giving us the data that we can statistically extrapolate to say, well, this is the condition of the lakes in our state.
The study identifies an expanding list of chemicals in the water, but it doesn't answer the question of how the chemicals get into the lakes. Sewage treatment plants and septic systems are often a source of pharmaceuticals and other chemicals, but chemicals were found even in remote lakes with no roads nearby. Scientists suspect some chemicals, like cocaine, are in the air and settle into the lakes. Some chemicals might be falling with the rain. Ferre says it's an area that needs more research. All of these chemicals are found at very low levels, often a few parts per trillion. What's a part per trillion? Now think of a football field-sized swimming pool, four stories deep. Add one drop of water. That's one part per trillion.
The concentrations that we're seeing at part per trillion level are vanishingly small, but there are more and more pieces of the puzzle coming together to show that, yes, they can affect organisms in our environment in ways that are very unsettling.
Ferre points to recent research in Minnesota that found low levels of contamination cause behavioral changes in baby fish that make them less likely to survive. And studies in mice found genetic damage for four generations after pregnant mice were exposed to bisphenol A, the plastics chemical. Mark Ferre says the research on trace amounts of chemicals and pharmaceuticals is still very early. He says 60,000 to 80,000 chemicals are in use, but only 91 are regulated by the Federal Clean Water Act. Ferre says there's a parallel to the 1970s, when scientists began to understand the damage from industrial pollution.
The emphasis in the 70s was, well, here's this pipe spewing out waste into our river, and we've got to put a stop to it. And we did. I think now what we need to do a little bit is to look in the mirror. Now, what are the products that I use, and what are the products going into the waste stream that end up in our surface water?
Ferre says the MPCA plans to continue testing lakes and streams to see if the level of chemicals increases or decreases over time.
Dan Gunderson on the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi. Have you paid your bill for the podcast yet? You can do so at nprnews.org, or you could call 1-800-227-2811 during this spring membership drive.